There's even cases of direct collusion between big media and big carbon. There's one case came to light a few years ago of a reported arrangement between the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers and Post Media, which is Canada's biggest newspaper corporation, whereby the big oil cap would pay Post Media to produce basically advertorials. They look like news stories, but they're really part of a program that they call thought leadership, intended to direct attention towards energy issues in a way that is favorable to the fossil fuel industry.
That's Robert Hackett, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Robert Hackett on climate change and the media. Climate change poses a long-term threat to humanity and the Earth. 60% of people get their news from TV. How are the networks reporting on the crisis? This is from a study from Media Matters, a nonprofit media watchdog organization. In 2016, evening newscasts and Sunday shows on ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox collectively decreased, yes, you heard me, decreased their total coverage of climate change by 66% compared to the previous year. Even though there were a host of important climate-related stories, including global record-breaking temperatures, the signing of the Paris Climate Agreement, and numerous climate-related extreme weather events. Apart from PBS, the networks also failed to devote significant coverage to climate-related policies, but they still found the time to uncritically air climate denial, the majority of which came from now President Donald Trump and his team. To talk about climate change and the media is Robert Hackett. He's professor in the School of Communication at Simon Fraser University, SFU, in Burnaby, British Columbia. He has published widely on media issues and is co-author of Journalism and Climate Crisis. He spoke at SFU in Burnaby. And now, Robert Hackett.
So I'm taking as a starting point that human-induced climate change is ongoing and poses an existential threat to human society, and that it's something that can no longer be ignored, and it's not really debatable in terms of the science by and large being settled. But what we really do need to debate is about what we can and should do in response to climate change. Humanity has basically, you know, not risen to the challenge so far to address it. So it's a failure of political will and communicative capacity, not just of technology. Climate change is a crisis in a double sense. It has a biophysical reality that we cannot ignore, but it acquires presence as a crisis only when it's discursively represented as such. It has to be made to mean for us to be able to respond to it. And in that response, journalism has an unavoidably key position. We're talking about climate change placing demand not only on openly political institutions, but on journalism as one of modernity's most important forms of storytelling. Journalism's recognized functions include setting agendas for publics and policymakers, helping to define social problems, to certify issues and events as publicly relevant, and to help fix the meanings of these events, constructing hierarchies of access to the public realm, participating in constructing or mediating subjectivity, the way we think and see ourselves in the world, legitimating or challenging established institutions and ways of thinking, and helping to create or undermine communities and social movements. There are four basic roles in a democracy for journalism. The monitorial role is the most widely recognized one. It involves just simply reporting on current and recent events and scanning the horizon for future developments, and in liberal democracies, focusing or at least critically scrutinizing potential abuses of power. But a second role is that of facilitating the public sphere, facilitating broadened public debate and participation beyond simply just reporting events. A third role, which is less recognized in conventional journalism textbooks, we might call the radical role, one that foregrounds social injustice and inequalities and abuses of power, and the potential for political and social change, often in opposition to established authorities and in sympathy with social movements representing marginalized groups. So radical journalism aims to eliminate concentrations of power to achieve true equity and fair participation in decisions affecting society. So that's a third role, the radical role. A fourth role is probably the least recognized in the West. They call it the collaborative role, in which journalism supports broader social and dominance political purposes, dealing with crises to promoting economic and social development. And that's a role much more openly recognized in countries of the global south or the so-called developing world. And what we argue in this book, amongst other things, is that climate crisis necessitates more facilitative and radical journalism. So if we go back to then the question of what are journalism's role in democracy, journalism in the West, at least, is generally evaluated by how well it makes democracy work. For what are the tasks for journalism as an inherently political practice? The first one we identify is that of market liberalism and elitist democracy, a minimalist view of democracy not as an end in itself, but as the best institutional arrangement for political stability and a liberal political culture. That protects individual rights, particularly in the marketplace. Democracy is basically reduced to a procedure for selecting between competing teams of elites. This, of course, was classically outlined by Joseph Schumpeter decades ago. It's one in which ordinary citizens can't realistically be expected to understand complex policy options. So their role is, our role, is one of occasional consumers in the political marketplace, helping to choose between competing teams of leaders. What's journalism to do in this model? Basically to act as a watchdog in government, which is seen as the main threat to individual freedom, report on intra-elite debates, and circulate supposedly objective information that is useful to policy elites. And that was a vision of politics in the media articulated almost a century ago now by the legendary American political columnist Walter Lippmann. A second model is that of deliberative democracy, which I sometimes call public sphere liberalism, that puts a higher value on popular participation in political life and sees participation as a means to better policy outcomes, as well as to develop citizens' democratic capacities. Journalism in this role is to help produce or help maintain a vibrant public sphere, to monitor power, but also to encourage public participation. Journalism would provide a civic forum to sustain both pluralistic political competition and the search for consensus. But our third model is, it's really not a single model, but a whole tradition, I suppose, of radical egalitarian democracies, starting with a recognition that capitalism helps to generate liberal democracy historically, but also, on the flip side, constrains popular sovereignty. Partly because economic inequalities are too easily translated into political inequality. So in this, if you like, a socialist view of power and democracy, what's expected of news media? Well, I think in a democratic socialist society, media would endorse the watchdog and public sphere functions, but they would also more actively engage in advocating social change. Journalism should actively counterbalance power inequalities generated elsewhere in society. Journalism should be biased in favor of equality, because if it is not, it will just unwittingly reproduce inequality just through its conventional structures and routines. So the role of journalism in this view then would be to report events and voices which are socially important but outside or even opposed to the agendas of elites. It should enable horizontal communication between subordinate groups, or as they say now, intersectionality, groups like workers, women, ethnic minorities, and social movements as agents of democratic renewal. One of the foremost writers, of course, on radical democracy today now would be Chantal Mouffe, who argues that democratic institutions should not try to establish a rational consensus in the public sphere, but rather defuse potential hostility in human societies by promoting peaceful rather than violent conflict and transforming potential enemies into mere adversaries. Journalism, in this model, should be objective about factual truths. In other words, we don't want fake news or alternative facts, but pluralistic about interpretations and perspectives. So that would be pluralism through the media, which needs to be paralleled by pluralism of the media, that is, diversity of ownership and broadened participation in producing media and making decisions about media policy. I think those are dominant traditions in Western, you know, contemporary or recent political thought about democracy. I think we have to ask the question of whether climate crisis disrupts the very notion of democracy. Does it disrupt these models of democracy and their associated expectations of journalism? Because besides straining institutions' adaptive capacity to the limit, climate crisis also calls into question conventional liberal rationales for democracy, which are by and large anthropocentric. The various models of democracy that I've just outlined have in common the value of expanding individual autonomy and freedom. And David Held, sort of one of the key theorists of democracy, sort of sees that as the core democratic value. This view, I think, takes for granted the separation of humans from nature and the ethical priority of humans over nature. But arguably, the condition of planetary emergency that climate crisis presents forces us to rethink, perhaps, what if we've reached the end of growth? What if instead our starting point is the inherent embeddedness of human civilization in the broader ecosphere, and the realization that our abuse of that relationship is jeopardizing the continuation of the human project? So that raises new questions. How does political decision-making incorporate accountability to future generations and to non-human species? What kind of restrictions do majorities need to place on their own freedom now in order to facilitate future freedom for others? What indeed does a politics of sustainability look like? Well, for some people, global crisis justifies declaring a state of emergency. You may recall the name James Lovelock, the author of the originator of the Gaia hypothesis, the notion of the planet as a self-regulating single complex system, and for several decades a leading voice in the international environmental movement. He said in a Guardian interview a few years ago that even the best democracies agree that when a major war approaches, democracy must be put on hold for the time being. Climate change may be an issue as severe as a war. It may be necessary to put democracy on hold for a while. So we argue against that view because I think that eco-authoritarianism or eco-elitism dubiously assumes, amongst other things, that the world is already democratic, that we live in a cheeky world where everyone can have their say, and that's James Lovelock's phrase from that same interview. The reality is, of course, I think the contrary. The governing logics of most states in globalized capitalism are skewed towards capital accumulation, and without popular pressure, political elites are less rather than more likely to support remedial environmental policies. I think that planetary emergency law would yield regimes of plunder more naked and brutal than what we already have, generating even faster ecological decline unchecked by the cries of its victims. And I think that the events of the past year, during 2016, have sort of confirmed that, you know, dictatorship and environmental decline generally go hand in hand. In moments of crisis, indeed, outright fascism remains a standby option for those who would install an authoritarian regime in order to preserve the main workings of the system. That's a quote from Joel Covell, who's an eco-socialist writing in a book which is now 10 years old. So we argue that the prospects for legitimate and effective climate change policy really depend on more democracy, especially the engagement, support, and buy-in from millions of people whose lives are affected already by climate change. In line with that assumption, after earlier flirtations with authoritarianism and anarchism, mainstream green political thought gravitated by the early 2000s towards deliberative democracy as the decision-making model is most conducive to mobilizing collective action to deal with climate crisis. So deliberative democracy, as I suggested earlier, is associated with the idea of a public sphere and rational participation in a search for consensus. But what if there are special interests vested in a high carbon economy that don't want to deliberate in good faith? What do you do then? And I'm going to draw here on the admittedly, you know, overused analogy of the Earth, planet Earth, as Titanic. If we're passengers on the Titanic, we have a shared interest in keeping the ship afloat, but there's conflicting ideas on how to do that. And there's competing and unequal claims to the lifeboats. You know, the passengers in the privileged suites of the global north have privileged access, so they may be less concerned about the danger. And still, the captain is forging full steam ahead, and collective survival may depend on stopping or replacing the captain. Well, it's an admittedly stretched metaphor, but we can, to take it even further, what if the captain is difficult to identify? What if the absence of an obvious target has been a key challenge or a problem for the environmental movement? And the environmental theorist Bill McKibben, an activist, has argued that that's been the key problem of the environmental movement over the past 20 years, and the explanation for its relative lack of policy impact is that it hasn't had a target to focus on. I mean, talking about changing light bulbs or, you know, reducing our own individual consumption, A, isn't going to be very effective, it doesn't work fast enough, and B, as McKibben said in a now well-known article in Rolling Stone magazine published in 2012, he said, that's like declaring war on ourselves. So he argues, both on strategic grounds and principled grounds, that we should identify the fossil fuel industry as a reckless rogue industry, that the crisis is really very much supply-driven, supplier-driven by the fossil fuel industry and its weddedness, embeddedness in a high-emission economy. He argues that on strategic grounds, rapid transformative change requires building a movement, and movements require enemies. So in that light, the concept of public sphere needs to be conceptualized as operating within movements for social and environmental change and against the political and economic sponsors of ecocide, which a role that implies a rather expanded position for subaltern counter-public spheres that can identify and articulate the interests of dominated groups on a transnational basis before re-engaging and challenging the keepers of the global order. So in this view, public spheres are inherently conflictual. Effective climate change responses will likely require the mobilization of millions of ordinary people. And Naomi Klein argues in her book, This Changes Everything, about Capitalism Versus the Climate, that the foremost form of such mobilization today has been called blockadia, local, community-based, but transnationally connected resistance to extractivist mega-projects. We still find the public sphere a useful concept for mobilizing people for a just and effective response to climate crisis, because it's got several aspects to it that we don't want to just abandon. We don't want to toss out the baby with the bathwater. The public sphere, in principle, ultimately, is open to everyone. It's linked to the use of reason and evidence to adjudicate disagreements. It's guided by a search for a public interest broader than private interests, and it is potentially convertible to different scales, although there's, you know, the question of how you do that is a very, very important one. But legacy media, so-called conventional legacy media, TV networks and the daily press and so on, are falling short of the needs of the times. And we reviewed both the academic research and conducted interviews with independent media makers and environmental communicators in the Vancouver area. And those interviews and focus, we also did focus groups with ordinary citizens concerned about climate change but not yet actively politically involved. And all that evidence suggests about six or eight main problems with conventional news media. One is simply a lack of coverage and of editorial resources devoted to the problem of climate change relative to the scale of the problem. For many years in the United States, there was a false balance between climate science and climate science deniers, who were often, as we now know, funded directly or indirectly by the fossil fuel industry. People by now talk of new climate denial, people who pay lip service to the science but refuse to recognize and enact the policy implications of what the science is telling us. The key problem is not a lack of coverage or information, but rather how journalism presents the issue and what kind of responses it generates in audiences and publics. The dominant media's focus on disaster, threat, and elite political squabbling generate a hope gap, leaving audiences, even those most alarmed by climate change, with a sense of disengagement and powerlessness. rather than a feeling of efficacy. So coverage is episodic and compartmentalized. It doesn't often connect the dots between, for example, the manifestations of climate change and its causes and consequences. Other problems that our interviewees identified include dependence on a narrow range of official sources, an overemphasis on disasters rather than positive change. When the media do look at solutions, our interviewees felt that they look too much at technology and individual green consumerism rather than collective approaches and policy options. There isn't enough attention to who bears responsibility for climate change, little critical analysis of capitalism or even of the fossil fuel industry. And yet, although climate change is often ignored in the news, it is sometimes framed as inevitable, which generates a sense of defeatism, arguably. And some of our interviewees argued that when the media focus on environmental conflicts, that's unproductive, although there's some difference of view I'll get in a moment as to what should replace the conflict narrative in terms of climate change policy is covered. I think that these various complaints are actually consistent with a lot of scholarship on the political economy of news media, the structure of news media, so that they're almost, what I've just described, are almost predictable outcomes of the structure and imperatives of contemporary news media, which include a collapsing business model. Its audiences are declining and fragmenting. Advertising revenues are moving to digital media or direct marketing. And even in the heyday of advertising-supported commercial media, media had their biases that were related to that dependence, not necessarily direct advertising advertiser interventions, but a bias towards consumerism, for example, or a bias in the system as a whole towards affluent consumers rather than the less well-heeled that I think can be shown historically. A commercial media system overprivileges affluent consumers. Since the 1980s, really, media conglomerates are maximizing short-term profits, stripping assets, and disinvesting in news, so that journalists have tighter deadlines, heavier workloads, multi-platform demands. There's fewer beat reporters, less accountability or watchdog journalism, more pressure, basically, to be stenographers. That's the current work situation. We see just even in the last week, 50 more journalists were laid off at our two major daily newspapers here in Vancouver. Beyond that, I think that conventional media face barriers of institutional structure and class power and ideology. I think there's an ideological animus or hostility to the collective policy approaches needed for climate crisis, just in the culture of editorial boardrooms across the country. There's a growing integration of news media with finance capital, the concentration and globalization of news media ownership, and the expansion of the global public relations industry. And I think the ratio now is something like 4 or 5 to 1 of public relations practitioners to professional journalists in North America. And that ratio has been going up for 10 or 20 years. There's even cases of direct collusion between big media and big carbon. There's one case came to light a few years ago of an arrangement, a reported arrangement between the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers and Post Media, which is Canada's biggest newspaper corporation, whereby the big oil cap would basically pay Post Media to produce basically advertorials that look like news stories. It says in the fine print, you know, that this is sponsored content. But I'm sure those of you here have seen that in our daily press in the last year or two. They look like news stories, but they're really part of a program that they call thought leadership, intended to direct energy, direct attention towards energy issues in a way that is favorable to the fossil fuel industry. And I think that commercial online journalism does not promise much better. It's driven by clickbait-oriented editorial decision-making, you know, stories that get the fastest clicks tend to be privileged in editorial decision-making about what's going to be covered in the future. And that's the kind of instant feedback you can get that in online journalism, right? That you can measure the clicks, that what people decide they like very, very quickly. And it's usually, you know, the easiest and stories, you know, cute doggy. Why do we see so many cute doggy stories now on television news? You can't go for more than 20 minutes without at least one cute animal story. And you have to ask, okay, if they're using the time to do that, what are they not covering? So what kind of journalism do we need, according to our respondents and our focus groups? Well, assuming that popular engagement and mobilization is needed to overcome the vested interests of big carbon, we need things like solutions journalism. And David Beers, the founder of the Tai'i online newspaper here in Vancouver, argues that there's three types of solutions journalism that they do at the Tai'i. That includes living the solution. People are already changing their lifestyles in ways that, you know, reduce their carbon footprint. But also larger scale but local successful experiments and how to scale them up. That's another kind of solutions story. And also what policies, more general policies, have worked elsewhere in other jurisdictions. Solutions journalism is one thing that would engage people more than simply, you know, bludgeoning them with stories of disasters and threat. Not that that's unimportant. We do need to convey the urgency of the problem as well, but also provide potential solutions so that people don't get overwhelmed. And in that process, journalism could get away from sterile, alienating conflict narratives that portray politics as basically a spectator sport, something that's done to us rather than by us, and instead either find points of agreement between competing interests or tell conflict stories that engender outrage and mobilize people. So we need to distinguish between alienating, cynical conflict frames versus accessible, generative, and mobilizing conflict narratives. We also could do with more journalism that normalizes political engagement, that treats it as something that ordinary people do, that it's people like your neighbors who are engaged in fighting, for example, the Kinder Morgan pipeline, and offer counter-narratives and frames against acquisitive, big carbon-driven capitalism. And I want to suggest very briefly three possible oppositional frames. One would be that of enshrining the rights of nature, the notion of the rights of nature. And here, the example of, it may seem a bit odd in this context, but of Ecuador, which in 2008 became the first country to constitutionally enshrine the rights of nature to exist, persist, maintain, and regenerate its vital cycles, structures, functions, and processes in evolution, an approach that defines nature as a rights-bearing entity that should be treated with parity under the law. And since then, I think several other countries, like Bolivia and Mongolia, have followed suit. So maybe there's some lessons to be learned there. It's very difficult to apply this in practice because obviously nature can't literally speak for itself in a court of law, and they're very powerful interests, as we found in practice, even in Ecuador, that will weigh against it. But nevertheless, it offers a vision, it offers an opening, I think, to think of nature as something that isn't simply a means to enhance our own short-term well-being, but think of nature as a way to sustain our own habitat in the long run, to let long-term stewardship trump short-term economic exploitation, and to provide legal tools that makes it easier to do that. So the rights of nature is one possible counter-narrative or alternative frame. Another one would be eco-socialism, which starts from a view that capitalism's inherent drive for endless capital accumulation is the key force behind the ongoing destruction of humanity's planetary habitat. So that the drive to exploit nature and labor links ecological destruction with poverty and inequality. And I think a few years ago, you know, the eco-socialist slogan, system change, not climate change, might have seemed, you know, pretty wacko or pretty far out, but I think it's striking chords much, much more loudly in the past couple of years. And one example would be Pope Francis's 2015 encyclical on care for our common home. He doesn't actually use the phrase capitalism, but he's clearly offering in that encyclical a systemic critique of global capitalism, and calling for the kind of values that historically have been advocated by socialism.
You're listening to Robert Hackett on climate change and the media. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
Climate justice is both a concept and a growing transnational movement based on the premise that those of us who have most benefited from or contributed to atmospheric dumping should shoulder most of the burden of addressing the crisis. And in a special issue of the New Internationalist magazine, they outlined four principles for practically implementing climate justice. First, the rich, the globally rich, that's not just the already industrialized countries, but also wealthy elites within both the global north and south, should take the main responsibility for the burdens of adjustment, given their role in creating and perpetuating the crisis in the first place, which means that we in the global north need to cut our greenhouse gas emissions more than those in the south, because there is the sort of countervailing concept of energy justice. There are people, you know, that don't even have access to basic electricity. Second, most fossil fuels need to be left in the ground and investment redirected to energy efficiency and community-controlled renewable energy. Third, solutions need to be both fair and effective, protecting people's rights, jobs, and well-being. And finally, natural resources should be conserved for the common good, not private or unsustainable exploitation. And people's sovereignty over resources need to be reclaimed. But I think, obviously, that's a notion, climate justice, that would be somewhat of a difficult sell amongst the electorates of the global north. If it's, you know, calling for reduced energy consumption and probably increased taxation or prices for carbon. So it arguably involves not just a fundamental political shift, but also a cultural one. Media have a role in this. Media help reinforce particular ways of being and seeing ourselves in the world. Media, in this view, could present active citizenship, community engagement, and shared sacrifice as something that is normal, as well as something that we need and ought to do. So we need more stories of people working together to make positive political changes, and maybe fewer SUV ads or Donald Trump-style reality television. So where do we find this kind of news? How do we get there? It's most likely to be found in alternative media, characterized by oppositional content, by participatory production, by an orientation towards mobilizing people rather than simply entertaining or merely informing them, by an engagement with communities, by ownership and control that is independent from states and corporations, by a low degree of capitalization, and often produced by volunteer labor. Alternative media accounts of climate and energy issues are indeed more hopeful, optimistic, and engaged, less cynical and spectatorial, and more likely to present political action as viable, engaging, and meaningful forms of agency. Such media embody the facilitative role of journalism, a conscious effort to improve the quality of public life and to promote active citizenship. And this sometimes shades into the radical role of supporting social movements, representing disenfranchised groups, and advocating for more fundamental social change. I just want to turn to the question of, you know, why aren't alternative media, how do you scale them up? It's got to be done through public policy. We can't rely on the market alone to bring about a better media system. Very briefly, we could argue that corporate media are a case of market failure. And more media scholars are using this concept, which is taken from, you know, conventional economics, to argue for why we need public policy to produce the kind of journalism that a democracy needs, especially in the context of climate crisis. And I'm just going to quote a phrase from Victor Picard, who has a recent book on America's struggle for media democracy. To define the notion of market failure, it's a situation in which the market is unable to efficiently produce and allocate resources, especially public goods. This often occurs when private enterprise withholds investments in critical social services because it cannot extract the returns that would justify the necessary expenditures, or when consumers fail to pay for such services' full societal benefit. So in other words, there are things that society needs, like quality journalism, that really can't be financed through the individual purchases of commodities. It's very difficult to do that. The classic textbook case, I suppose, is streetlights. You can't really pay for streetlights on the basis of user pay. Or national defense is another textbook case. But, more and more people are thinking of journalism as a public good, and a case of market failure that requires public investment. And one of the reasons, of course, is that as a public good, it's difficult to exclude news from those who don't pay for it. You can get a lot of news for free. So that's one of the reasons it's difficult to finance through marketplace mechanisms. And good journalism also has positive externalities because, it's to our benefit to have neighbors who are well-informed, who are capable of making better political decisions when it's time to vote. And arguably, we get better government through, better journalism. If you want climate action, we need better democracy. If you want better democracy, we need better media. And if we want better media, we need structural media reform. That is, change of media policies and structures. It won't happen through the marketplace on its own. How is it that in the United States, 60 million people supported a presidential candidate who, in the view of critics and possibly even a majority of Americans, is practicing a politics of contempt against vulnerable groups, who is sexist and racist, who is reckless, ignorant or indifferent to the Constitution he's supposed to uphold, has apparently large conflicts of interest between business and his presidential duties, who is militarist, has no coherent economic policies, and for current purposes is a climate science denier who is actively working to undo already inadequate environmental protections. I do think that media pundits have paid too much attention to Trump as a personality, and we need to focus more on the political vacuum that he exploited. We could suggest that there's an inherent tension in any liberal democracy between freedom and equality, and that in the United States, a particular narrow version or notion of freedom has become dominant and is overriding considerations of equality. Freedom defined as property ownership that really gained momentum since the Reagan administration, when you could measurably start to see the rise of income inequality, that ultimately undermines civil society and a sense of fairness between citizens. In other words, the kind of civil culture that you need to address ecological crisis is undermined by the sense that the system is rigged, that it's not fair, that some people are paying a far greater price for environmental protection than others, for example. There's also, of course, the ongoing question of race in America, history of slavery, conquest, and genocide, which, amongst other things, has left white fear and white racism as a toxic reservoir, easy for demagogues to mobilize. Extreme individualism in American culture versus, at the same time, a desire for community and social solidarity, which results, I think, in sort of paradoxical phenomena like, cults that celebrate individualism. The Tea Party, I think, had some characteristics of that. You have the tension in American culture in particular. And I want to say, of course, I'm speaking from a Canadian perspective, somewhat outside, but I spend about 10% of my time in the United States, mainly California, which isn't necessarily representative. But I could sort of see, looking back on it, signs of the current phenomena of a wholesale alienation from conventional politics and from liberal democracy. Just in people's conversations and the way they were talking about race, about minorities, about economic security. I met one woman whose plans for retirement were basically to rob a bank. This is just after the 2008 financial collapse. So that either she'd be arrested and would have free room and board for the rest of her life, or she'd get the money and sustain herself. So that kind of desperation, she seemed to be quite serious, is not good for democratic politics. So you have a tension in American culture between secular views, a secular endorsement of science, technology, and materialism, versus a strong strand of puritanic messianic religion. One of our colleagues in history wrote a book called Have a Nice Doomsday, which suggests that I think up to a quarter of Americans believe that the judgment day is going to occur in their lifetime, and they're just fine with that. And again, that's something that doesn't seem conducive to a sense of long-term stewardship of the planet, to say the least. And it also makes it easier to reject science and evidence-based reasoning. So you've got that sort of cultural reservoir waiting to be tapped by someone like a Donald Trump. You also have a sense that the United States is an empire in decline, which can be quite dangerous. There's a nostalgia for the 1950s when America really did seem to be, you know, the world's, at least the so-called free world's hegemon. A crisis of masculinity, which is linked with deindustrialization and the decline of traditional male occupations. You have bad trade deals, at least trade deals that are perceived not to have benefited American workers. And it's not just people like Donald Trump. I think he's seized on real grievances that have been voiced for 10 years or more by people on the left, people like even Michael Moore, you know, the filmmaker, or Thomas Frank, the writer. You had the 2008 economic shock, in which banks were bailed out, but not homeowners. You had the Occupy movement uprising in 2011, which I think helped create the soil for Bernie Sanders' presidential candidacy. You have a fateful gap between workers and the Democratic Party, or between progressives and the working class in general, and a split between, you know, the industrial or ex-industrial working class and the urban professional middle class. That makes it easier to separate the notion of jobs from environmental protection, which I think is very, very dangerous. I think it's very politically productive for those on the right and for the fossil fuel industry to counterpose jobs versus the environment, as if they are necessarily antagonistic. So we need an idea like a just transition to a low-carbon economy in which resource and energy workers' jobs are, or at least incomes are protected, and that there's retraining for them. Another factor is the post-9/11 climate, a reaction to terrorism and a climate of fear, that again provides fertile soil for authoritarian responses and puts climate change way down the list of priorities. Does anybody know, a recent poll showed where climate change is as a issue priority for Americans? It was number 17, according to Harper's Index. And what was number one? Jobs. Also, political corruption often shows fairly high in American surveys. So that means, you know, these other issues, and it's too easy to push out the existential threat posed by climate change. It seems perhaps too distant an issue, or, you know, the right argues that it's a hoax to start with. But I want to also argue that the current political crisis in the United States and the shelving of climate change as an effective policy issue, momentarily at least, is related to the media. The media are not sort of innocent in all this. In the United States, it arguably has the weakest public service broadcasting of any Western country, any major Western country. And there's now research done by James Curran and his colleagues internationally showing that there actually is a link between quality journalism, particularly as through public service media like CBC or BBC, on the one hand, and political knowledge and engagement on the other. If you have a weak public service media, that's not good for political engagement and democratic politics. You've also had, since the 1980s in the United States, the emergence of right-wing hate media that was made possible in part by the Reagan administration's withdrawal of the Fairness Doctrine in the 1980s, so that media no longer, or at least broadcasters, no longer had to offer opportunities for counterbalancing views on controversial issues. You have a hyper-commercialized media system that arguably generates a lot of trivialization of, I call it, YouTube moments on television. A two-tiered media system, it seems to be emerging, in which you will still have quality journalism for the elite that's willing to pay for it, like the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, But for the rest of us, it's just basically schlock. And you have news values that focus on crime and terror. There's a measurable increase in what one group of researchers calls the Mayhem Index. They've been measuring American local TV news for about 20 years and find that the proportion of stories that are about crashes and crime is escalated enormously alongside the excessive commercialization of TV. And then we shouldn't forget the role of celebrity culture, and that the current president of the United States was himself a media celebrity to start with and was in part a product not only of a real estate empire, but of a reality television show called The Apprentice. That just, I think, reinforces the conclusion that if you want effective democracy and effective climate policy, we need better media and media reform to achieve that. There's really two questions here. One is about the potential of the millennial generation, mm-hmm. which is not very much involved in conventional politics, but is definitely interested in alternative sources of information. That would include something like alternative radio that we're speaking on now. That's one question. Is there, you know, what is the potential of the millennial generation to support media reform and media change? And a related question is, can universities and journalism schools play a role in this kind of change? I think the first one, the millennial generation, is, I think, very hopeful. I mean, we've all been teaching them for 20, 30 years. And I see a good deal of interest in finding out accurate information and understanding the world. They don't necessarily, you know, vote to the same extent that the older generations do. But we have found through the experience of open media that if you can engage with people where they're at, issues that concern them, like access to cell phones and to the internet, and threats to that from, say, big telecommunication companies' policies that want to close off or restrict that access through monopolistic practices, you can get them involved in even regulatory hearings. In terms of what role universities and journalism schools can play, it's possibly, I think, at least two. One is to promote critical media literacy and the connectedness between media and the quality of media and of journalism with good politics. The question is, what you're offering is a critique of deliberative democracy or public sphere deliberation as a means to bring about real change, because those very processes can be presumably co-opted or manipulated by established interests that don't want to shift to a lower carbon economy. So why not instead have a more radical approach that may tinge into authoritarianism? Deliberative democracy is not enough, that we do need more radical approaches. I think Bill McKibben and 350.org's strategy is to mobilize people against a particular vested interest, and that we need media that help do that, that raise the critical questions, that point out the sort of self-serving propaganda and interests of big carbon. So that would be a radical approach, right? That would be what they're calling the radical role of media. But I don't see that as necessarily authoritarian. I mean, that's where the contradiction comes in about can there be democratic radical movements. When you suggest that individual rights need a certain degree of curtailment in order to develop a more ecologically sustainable society, that's true in some ways, but other kinds of individual rights need to be enhanced. And we always have to ask, whose individual rights, which individuals are we talking about? So I think we may have to curtail individual rights, perhaps, of consumption and even of investment in, you know, carbon industries, for example. But the flip side is that you could enhance individual rights to a safe environment. You know, and there have been suggestions by the Suzuki Foundation, for example, that that should be constitutionally enshrined. Perhaps not the rights of nature, as I discussed earlier, but the idea of our right, individual right, and communities' rights to a safe environment, or even to safe drinking water, right? So that's a different notion of, or different kind, or different set of individual rights. We also have to talk about whose rights do get really enforced in the current political system, not just nationally, but globally. What about the millions of people who are suffering from the effects of climate change? What about their rights to food and water and air? So the question is, the kinds of changes that are needed can only be brought about through a tremendous degree of national and international coordination that really only states can do. and that backed by the coercive power of states, and that social movements can't do that on their own. But I would see a difference between an authoritarian approach and an authoritative approach. Okay, so is it not possible to conceive of governments that have a democratic mandate to proceed in an effective way to coordinate a response to climate change? Well, the question is, do you need an authoritarian government, or should we understand governments that that introduce effective environmental and climate policies to be necessarily authoritarian? Maybe we're quibbling about the notion or concept of authoritarian. It certainly needs to be effective. It needs to be backed with both a democratic mandate, but also with effective policy tools and indeed, mechanisms of coercion. That could include nationalizing industries. It could include, carbon taxes, penalties, as well as incentives for certain kinds of reduction and consumption. Mm-hmm. I don't disagree with that at all. I don't know if is it just the definition of the notion of authoritarian? To me, the notion of authoritarian implies a lack of accountability to a broader base. Can there be global standards across the board instead of a notion of climate justice that puts a greater onus on the wealthy countries in the north? But the problem is that we have already exceeded in global north what those global standards have to be, right? So, and there's many countries where, they're far lower, much smaller carbon footprints, and they don't have, the basic amenities of a decent life. So I did read an article in one of the political science journals from a sort of realpolitik perspective, saying that climate justice isn't just a moral issue, it's a sort of strategic imperative, because you're not going to get international agreement, at least from many of the countries of the South, unless you do recognize the different starting points that we're coming from. And that needs to be taken into account. It's not might makes right, but right makes might. Doing the right thing is what is necessary to bring about a global agreement. But you know what Anatole France said about equality, right? The law and its majesty forbids rich and poor alike from sleeping under the bridges at night. So there's different notions of equality. We're starting from very, very unequal standards of living and consumption patterns. Nobody says that an international agreement would be easy by any stretch of the imagination. But basically I've tried to focus on journalism.
Right.
That journalism, we should at least have space in our media system to be talking about these issues, and we're not. I mean, this is the kind of discussion that you don't get during election campaigns.
Right.
Or in day-to-day coverage. And by the way, I did want to sort of modify or qualify something about not having common sources of news, because people don't get newspapers anymore. But much of the news, 90% of people's news consumption online is from just the handful of the same corporations that dominated the traditional media, albeit now joined by Facebook and others, a couple of others that are mainly aggregators rather than originators of content. So a lot of the original content still comes from those traditional media. If you associate climate change with a particular left agenda, that becomes self-marginalizing, that it confines climate change to a kind of political ghetto or the corners of the political agenda, and it would be difficult to get out of it. But what I'm arguing is that media should at least, there needs to be space in the media system to at least discuss these ideas. There should be a stronger emphasis on the radical role of media in explaining and exploring the need for social change, for fundamental social change. How else can you deal with it other than through fundamental change? We're going to be fundamentally changed whether we like it or not, right? So we're living in a radical situation, and nothing short of a radical response is going to be anywhere near adequate, one way or another. So at least we need a media system that at least allows us space to discuss these issues. I'm by no means saying that media, journalism, should become instruments of propaganda on behalf of some particular cause or ideology. I think they need to broaden the scope of discussion and make climate crisis, put it higher in the agenda. Yeah. Thank you, Andy, and thank you for everybody for coming.
That was Robert Hackett on climate change and the media. He spoke at Simon Fraser University, SFU, in Burnaby, British Columbia. Robert Hackett, a noted expert on media issues, is professor in the School of Communication at SFU and co-author of Journalism and Climate Crisis. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Thomas Frank, Noam Chomsky, Kshama Sawant, Vandana Shiva, Max Blumenthal, David Corton, Bill McKibben, and Naomi Klein. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. The Kronos Quartet performs our theme music from Pieces of Africa. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.